Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast, coming to you from Montecito, California. And let's see, this week we're going to do something a little bit different. So last week I sent out an update on the WF Velocity ATM Fund, which is involving ATM machines, right? Had a lot of emails asking a lot of questions and clarifications and all that on this. This is a sophisticated business. It's not as simple as it sounds. And what I will say is that we have done an enormous amount of due diligence on this, particularly Zolfielli, who's our broker dealer, has who's spent a lot of time in the actual space where the ATM funds exist, and looking at machines and looking at talking to banks, talking to regulators, talking to CPAs and all that. And so it's a really interesting investment opportunity. And because we got so many, because I got so much feedback, so many questions last week, I just ended up emailing my partner on this, Daryl Heller. And I said, Daryl, why don't you come on the podcast? You haven't been here in a while. Let's talk. Hopefully you find this interesting. I certainly do. I think it's a good play. I've been, investing in this particular fund for, about 7 years now. So, it's something to think about. I'm certainly not trying to just sell you on this, but give you some good information. So when we come back, Daryl Heller of Heller Capital and my partner on WF Velocity ATM.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Daryl Heller. Daryl has been on the show before. He is the founder of Heller Capital. Part of Heller Capital is its partnership with our group through the WF Velocity ATM Fund. And Daryl, welcome to the program.
Buck, thrilled to be with you today. Thank you for the opportunity.
So I just wanted to sort of give a background a little bit on, I know we just launched the new fund and we thought maybe it would be a good idea to sort of just refresh people's memories about what this kind of investing is and all that kind of thing. But, I discovered this stuff through you. And let me ask you this, you have a very interesting background. How'd you end up, give us a little bit of that background and ultimately, what brought you into the ATM space?
Yeah, glad to. So 1990, I was a telecom entrepreneur, sort of my first company when I was in college. We founded a concept in the brokerage procurement analyst space, built that until throughout the 90s. In 1997, we did a roll up on Wall Street and had a successful exit. And then in 2001, subsequent to that, built a group of companies under a brand called Premier Communications and or Premier Companies. One of our entities was Premier Communications. And we had telecom, tech, and energy divisions, and led that for a little over a decade. Had a very strong executive team alongside of me. And in 2011, going into 2012, decided to take a sabbatical to decide what I wanted to do when I grew up. At that point, I was essentially 40 and went away for a couple months and came back from that, having written a 10-year plan. And that 10-year plan was to enter into what we call boutique private equity. So that is Heller Capital. We have a unique ethos. Today, we are in 8 different asset classes. We have 18 portfolio companies. One of those asset classes is financial services, and that's where ATMs play. Our 2 emerging markets are crypto. We play heavily in that, and cannabis and tech. Right. So that's a little about me.
Yeah. Why ATMs? How'd you get in this space?
No, it's an interesting question. Back in 2011, going into 2012, we had a technology called proximity marketing, which was very prevalent in Europe. And we were trying to identify a place that we could house it. And a logical repository ended up being ATMs, given the high-priced real estate that they're in. And ATMs at that point did and still do today had forms of internet connectivity, and we needed internet to be able to deploy our tech. So it was really out of default. And at that point, did a lot of diligence on the space, found out there's strong operating margins, found out there was a lot of hedge money in it. And we domiciled on the ATM space to deploy our tech. That tech has since is no longer part of, you know, our investment or part of what we're doing. But that was the entree into ATMs. And from there, just became more and more bullish on the space and continued to build it.
Yeah. So that was what year again? When you said you started?
That was 2011 going into 2012.
Yeah. And then when did you really start launching these funds in the ATM space?
Our first fund, I believe, was officially launched. It was more of a friends and family peer play. I think our first fund was launched in 2016. So five years.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I guess the question I think a lot of people may have is, well, you think about ATMs and, you know, automatic teller machines and banks and things like that. It's pretty rare that, you know, people use these things, you and me at least. And so what is the, like, I get ultimately, what's the, who's using these things and what makes you think this is going to be a space in the next few years?
Yeah. So, you know, I asked myself that same question, inclusive of cash, back in 2011, going into 2012. And I quickly learned that it's a demographic that's different than our demographic. And it's characterized as unbanked and underbanked. Back then, it was probably about 27-28% of our country. Today, the most recent report I saw is it's 34%. There's a little over 10% in the unbanked category. And a little over 24% in the underbanked. So you add those two up, it's over a third of U.S. adults are unbanked and underbanked. And the utilization of the ATM is more of a bank to them. So that demographic is growing. That demographic is strong. Therein lies the strategic placement of our kiosk. There's certain places we are not. There's places we are. For example, back in 2016, 2017, we deselected malls, just given online retail. But again, when you're in bodegas, convenience stores, you know, laundromats, smoke shops, liquor stores, it's a demographic that is very prevalent in those places. And therefore, the activity and transactional use is very high.
So, you know, again, this goes back to evolving stuff with regard to the role of central bank distributed coin, those types of technologies that people worry about. One thing that you said is of interest to me, which is that the ATMs are serving as a bank to the underbanked, essentially. And with that in mind, do you foresee there being a role of these types of machines, even in the event of a potential cashless society in the future? In other words, is this the mobile bank of the underbanked, even if there was no cash? I guess that's the question.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think there's a lot of thesis out there as to where cash is going. I'll start by saying when I did my diligence back in 2011, I read a article in the Wall Street Journal from 1999, and that article said that cash would be dead in 10 years. So that would have been 2009. I was 2 years subsequent to that, and the monetary system was growing, and that still is right. The case today. So I'll start from the premise of I don't think cash is going away for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of data as to how much the monetary system and cash has grown in the last 3, 4, 5 years. It's substantial. It's material. It's on a 4 to 5% CAGR. So I don't think cash is going away. There is, you know, countries that have tried to go cashless. Every single one of those has reversed that initiative over the last decade. We have had certain pockets in this country. New York City has had pockets. Chicago, quite a few of the tier one cities. Have had retailers that have tried to go credit card only, and that has been deemed as constitutionally illegal. And you see that being reversed. So I'm a firm believer that I don't think this society is going to turn into cashless. But more specifically to your point, yes, this is a, you know, this is a bit of a banking device for the unbanked and underbanked. And if you think about unbanked, they don't have a bank account. Underbanked or underbanked in terms of services. So the future of this space, I think, is really predicated on being a financial service provider. When you look at our model and the evolution of our model, it's more into think neobank, think fintech, think financial services. And this kiosk and this device, to your point, can serve as a banking interaction for unbanked and underbanked. Yeah. So the future of the space, I believe, is that the underserved community of unbanked and underbanked is going to be banked somewhere. And a lot of people believe it's going to be a financial services device such as a kiosk, which is what you're starting to see.
And just for clarity, too, I mean, people are thinking to themselves probably, well, gosh, if you don't have a bank account, then how are you at the ATM in the first place? There are government services and, you know, the way money is distributed to people and that sort of thing as well. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, you know, our government subsidy welfare program, call it what you want, is done through, it's called EBT, and it's done through a debit card. But you think about people that don't have bank accounts, they still have access to debit cards. Yes, our government is providing a debit card, and that's where the subsidies come out. So the only place for those for them really to get cash is an ATM. They're pretty much subject to using the ATM as their bank.
Right.
So, yes, unbanked is heavy on debit cards. And, you know, if you look at the future model side of this, you know, it's going to be utilized for, you know, re-upping your, you know, wireless provider, your minutes, et cetera. So that whole debit card concept plays heavily both today from a underbanked or unbanked environment, but also from a future service environment. And when you look at how these machines are being used to do re-ups.
Let's talk a little bit about the business model itself as far as the fund goes. How do ATM machines in the model that the fund works, explain how it makes money? Is it just simply a matter of the fees, or are there other sources of income? What is the licensing? You know, obviously there's ATM sitting in individual businesses. I mean, they got to get paid. So what are all the moving parts in this business?
Yeah, so let's talk revenue sources. I'll kind of answer your questions chronologically. Yeah. The revenue sources are, they start with surcharge. So that's the one that is well known. You walk up to an ATM, you pull out cash, and you pay whatever, $2, $3, sometimes lower, sometimes higher, to pull your cash out. So that is a, you know, a material amount of the revenue generated. But the sources of revenue go well beyond that. For those that have used an ATM, you will recognize by and large when you walk up to an ATM, it's going to ask you if you want to check your account balances, which is almost a nuisance to see because it sometimes is hard to get out of that screen and get into, you know, pulling money out. But that's for a reason. That's strategic in that every time you check your account balance, there's something called interchange. Coming from the financial networks. So interchange is you know, it varies per provider, but it can be, you know, 25 plus minus cents per transaction. So essentially, if you're going to go pull out money from an ATM and you walk up and you check your account balance, which most people do, especially our demographic is more sensitive to what is in their account and how much they can pull out. So you swipe your card, and swiping your card, checking an account balance, sometimes two or three is 25 cents per balance that you check. And then at the end of that, you're naturally doing a transaction to pull cash out. So that's another 25 cents. So when you think about the stacking of it, let's just, for illustrative purposes, say it's a $3 surcharge. Plus, if you checked your account balance, it was 25 cents. And when you pulled your cash out at $3, it was another 25. So the all in on that is really 350, not $3.
Right.
So that's interchange. Another is dynamic currency conversion. It's called DCC. And that would be, for example, someone from Japan here, whether they're here on business or whether they're here as a tourist or on vacation. And when they want to go get USD, they will typically just walk to an ATM, put their card in, and they'll pull out on their side yen, and it'll convert to USD. And there is a significant fee for that. And we sometimes that fee is, you know, $4, $5, $6, $7, $8, $10. So we do have a few ATMs that actually make more on DCC than they make on surcharge. So that's a revenue stream that is increasing significantly in recent years. And then you've got bank branding. We have some of our ATMs that have a bank brand on them, which may look like it's a large Wall Street bank, when in reality it may be owned by our fund and the bank is just paying us to put their brand on it. And then lastly, you're starting to see more into the cash management side, and that is the future business model where there's cash recyclers in these, and a small merchant will actually deposit their cash into the ATM, and that is recycled. And that is, there's a fee to do that in lieu of them having a smart safe or going to the, you know, to the bank every night or hiring a courier or an armored service. They're depositing it into the ATM. We recycle it. And, you know, it works advantageous on both ways. It's a convenient service to the merchant. Sometimes there's the ability to set them up with provisional credit so they can access some of that cash they're putting in, but they're paying a fee to do it. Additionally, it significantly is lowering the COGS of the operator. If you think about the two largest COGS of an ATM, it would be cost of cash, which goes down significantly if the merchant is putting their own cash in, and then armored, the Brink's, Loomis, Garda pickups that occur on a, you know, weekly or biweekly or monthly basis. So, you know, the operator makes money in various forms and certainly well beyond surcharge, even though surcharge is an anchor to it. But some of these additional ancillary revenue streams are starting to increase significantly.
Now, what about, how does it work, Geraldine, in terms of maybe you could explain the relationship between where these machines are placed, like what kind of licensing is required there? I mean, in terms, or like, you know, you got to pay, say you're at a, just say a 7-Eleven or something like that. 7-Eleven itself doesn't necessarily own the ATM machine. It's, you know, us who owns the ATM machine, we got to pay them, right? And so how do those licensing agreements work, and is there value to those in it themselves?
Yeah, so generally one of two ways. They're either structured as a fixed rent, almost like a tenant to rent X square feet of the floor. That was more, you see that structure more typically in malls and those type of locations, but sometimes you see them in retail as well. Or it is a situation and a contractual agreement, whereas they share in a percentage of the surcharge, and or they're getting paid a fixed fee per month. If the operator has a real good understanding as to the performance of that location, sometimes they'll just pay them a fee per month, which is almost like a rental fee that's not tied to, you know, a piece of a percentage of, you know, square feet or a dollar amount tied to square feet. So I would say probably 80% of the constructs within our base are percentages of surcharge, nothing of interchange, nothing of the additional fees coming through, but a percentage of that surcharge that is generated from the machine.
Mm-hmm. Is there a value to those relationships in and of themselves? I'm curious, I guess the analogy I think about is, you know, on a much
like in New York City, where you have people who drive cabs. You know, remember, was it Trump's guy, his lawyer? He owned all these medallions, and the money was in the medallions, right? Like, is there a value to the actual relationships here too? Or is that, I'm just curious on that.
Yeah, I think when you look at the multiples in this space and what revenue trades at, it largely ties to that contractual agreement. So the answer is yes. And when you think about the ATM, it has certain obviously tangible value, but it's really the cash flow generated from that ATM, and that cash flow generated ties to that location agreement or that license agreement with the merchant. So ultimately, these agreements are typically 3 to 5 years. Sometimes they're 5 to 7. Sometimes they're even longer than that. So that is creating predictable revenue flow. And those contracts can be monetized at high level and certainly carry a intrinsic as well as enterprise value relative to, you know, having a 5-year agreement at a bodega in New York City that's generating X amount of revenue. So, yeah, there's definitely a value to it. And the operators are very focused on that piece.
So let's specifically tell us a little bit about the operator in this fund, which is Paramount.
Yeah. So, you know, Paramount is a IAD. So they are a, you know, they're certified in the space. They have a sponsor bank behind them.
What does that mean? Because it's an important point, but I want to make sure people understand what you mean by sponsor bank.
Yeah. So an IAD has to have a sponsor bank behind them, and a sponsor bank is required to ensure that the operator has strong financial health, has strong policies in place relative to processes, et cetera. And it's a, you know, it's a form of regulatory oversight. And they ultimately are ensuring that that management company or operator is in good financial shape. They are doing, you know, various levels of process, systems, you know, financial, otherwise audits, to ensure the viability of that operator. So most of the ATM operators out there, at least the smaller ones, are not IADs. They would be sub-IADs. They would be working with a larger operator and riding the rails, you know, right, of that sponsor bank and of that service. So yeah, sponsor bank is really a good housekeeping seal of approval. And they are the ones that sponsor to ride the financial networks. And that's essentially how this space works.
And Paramount, like in terms of size, is that one of the larger operators in the country?
Yeah, there is. You know, there's no statistical ranking of it, but, you know, you have one large public company out there. Most people know who that is, which is, you know, far beyond the others. And then you got a number two player and a number three player. And most people would suggest our operator is in that fourth position or tied for that fourth position with a few others. So
yeah,
there's literally thousands of ATM operators out there.
Sure.
Spaces under consolidation, and there's, you know, 10 or 15 of material size, and our operator is in that top four.
Well, maybe that's a good point to a good time to pivot into sort of how the fund works, because essentially, I guess the question is, for ATM fund investors, what are they investing in?
So they're investing in a fund, and they are becoming a member of an LLC. So they have a mm-hmm. membership interest in an LLC with a lot of other investors. The fund is buying the ATM and retains the ATM. And the fee structure is set up that for 7 years, we are paid a minimum fixed fee. That's essentially a pref. And obviously, if it's not generating enough revenue and the pref's not hit, then we'd be at risk of not paid the pref. But in all cases, historically, we've been paid the pref. And then beyond that, there's a variable piece. And that variable piece fluctuates monthly based on, you know, seasonality, et cetera. And that is essentially the variable piece is used to pay the fund operating expense. And then the remaining mm-hmm. margin is distributed to the fund manager as defined in the operating agreement.
So every month we have, we may or may not have a tranche. As it turns out, we have a decent sized tranche in March.
What determines whether or not there's a tranche? And I guess maybe you could talk a little bit about the consolidation that you were referring to earlier as part of that. What's going on there? Like, you know, there's a new tranche. What does that mean? We're buying ATMs. Is there new space that's available for ATMs? Are we replacing ATMs? What? Tell everyone about that.
Yeah, so the space is under consolidation. You're seeing a significant consolidation of mom-and-pop shops. And as noted earlier, there's literally thousands of operators out there. It's a very entrepreneur space. You had John or Sally, you know, buy a couple of ATMs, deploy them into locations, start to make money and scale it up to, say, 100, 150, 200. And then kind of hit that proverbial lid of they wake up and say, wow, I'm now operating a business and it's no longer fun. And you know, I was a sales and marketing biz dev individual, but now I have the headaches of running the business. So you're seeing a consolidation. A lot of those smaller mom and pops, and even larger than that, some that have 500, 1,000 ATMs under significant consolidation. And, you know, the economies of scale in this business work. For example, some of those smaller players may be paying, you know, $7, $8, $9 for their comms, their internet connectivity coming in. In our case, we're paying generally sub-3. Processing. A lot of them are paying 8, 9, 10 cents to process a transaction. We may be paying a penny, a little over a penny, or even sub 1 penny. So the M&A side, the cost synergies here at the COGS level are very, very significant. I just gave, you know, examples of two of them. But the space is under consolidation. You also have an element out there from a banking reg perspective that a lot of banks that were lending money to small little, we affectionately call them two bobs in a truck. They had a small little bank line and they were pulling cash and running around in a van and putting it into the ATMs. That has mostly ceased in the last 2 years. So that has also put a lot of these folks in a position where it's very capital intensive because they have to put their cash in the machine. They can no longer get a line of credit from a bank. It's their own personal cash plus buy the machine. So consolidation has been very strong the last couple of years. And, you know, when you have a space that's got thousands of players in it, and when you have the level of cost synergies at the M&A level that are in this space, you're seeing a very, very active, you know, transactional play that goes throughout this space. And, you know, you got a couple entities that are rolling up and, you know, our operator is certainly one of those. There's a few others out there as well. And I think we had opportunities maybe at 9 of the 12 month last year. So we didn't have it every month, but, you know, it's very active. And generally those transactions, we are given opportunity to fund those transactions and those ATMs get sold into our fund.
Got it. Interesting stuff. You know, it's probably worth mentioning like what the preferred returns are for the particular fund. I know this actually is a little bit different if somebody's investing $500,000 or more. Tell about the returns and how that all works out.
Yeah, so an investment unit is $104,000 for this fund, and the cash on cash returns are very strong. The depreciation opportunity is significant, but you really got to push this investment out 7 years and close it and then look back retroactively. So I think some people get caught up in the cash on cash returns and it looks too good to be true. And the cash on cash returns are very strong. But in reality, you got to go out 7 years, close it as a depreciating asset. And the buyback, you know, from the operator to the fund of the ATM is pennies on the dollar. So cash on cash, very high. And right now it's $2,168 per investment, you know, 104. Depreciation, you know, varies, but bonus depreciation has been out there for years. Right now in 2024, it's down to 60%, but it did pass in one of the houses to go back to 100. You know, one, certainly cannot predict whether it will or will not, but I would say it's likely that bonus depreciation will jump back up to 80 or 100. But even if it doesn't, 60% is very material. And, you know, you get the additional, you know, 40% over 5 year makers. So strong cash flow, strong depreciation, not really an equity play. And cash on cash is very strong and you have the predictable income coming in that you can reinvest. So if you model the reinvestment of that income, it can become very material. But when you push it out, close it down, and then look retroactively back over that 7-year return, you're somewhere in the teens. So still a strong return, but
yeah,
not the 20-some% cash on cash that I think some people get focused on. And in reality, your principal's not coming back, or a very small piece of your principal's coming back.
That's a really important point. I feel like sometimes that gets a little bastardized in the communications out there. And it is important to understand that what you're getting a total return. And if you, you know, you're best looking at it as an internal rate of return that takes into account the, you know, the time value of money and all that. And when you do that, it's an attractive return. It's typically in the low teens. I think the bigger issue, certainly for me, has been, you know, I've been, even before we started working together, and, you know, I've been investing with you for a while. And I think I just finished a fund, you know, seven-year fund. So it's been extremely consistent, even through COVID. How was it? Tell us about what that was like, because there was never a missed payment even throughout COVID. And how, you know, a lot of people wonder how that's possible. So
it created a lot of angst for me and for us at the fund level, at the operator level, going into COVID. And, you know, the first couple of weeks of COVID, when there was massive shutdowns, especially in larger cities, which is where we have heavy concentration, you know, we saw some significant runoff. But within, you know, 3-4 weeks, and certainly in the you know, next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, you started to see a lot of subsidy coming in at the government level. And that subsidy really turned into cash and ATM. So we saw you know, I think we were off maybe 13-14% for a 3-4 week period. And then we quickly rebounded back. And a lot of these ATMs are going 2 to 3 times the transactions. Now, our base didn't go up at that level because some of our ATMs were locked behind doors, businesses that were closed. But there was enough of businesses that were open that were deemed into that essential category, whatever the moniker was for it. And that's where a lot of our ATMs were. So in theory, because banks and otherwise were closed, we saw a massive uplift.
Right.
And it would have even been greater. But when you look at our global base, some of them were in non-essential locations. So they were shut down. And or 24-hour locations generally, you know, started to close at 10 or 11 at night, and they were no longer open 24/7. But it was a small hiccup, and we thought it could be more significant. But because, you know, cash is something that people need to access, and banks were closed, and or some banks were closed or not open the same hours, and this demographic in short order started to get surplus money coming in from the government, that you started to see the actual use of cash go higher and the use of an ATM go higher, because this is by and large what people were picking it up. And it was more comfortable to go walk up to an ATM and pull cash than it was to walk inside a bank as well. So there was a small hiccup. I think we all anticipated it would have been greater. But when you think about the context of what COVID was and how surpluses started to come in, it actually ended up being a real benefit over that, you know, core 18-24 month period of time.
So lots of variables, lots of different moving parts, and in what seems to be a relatively simple business model, doesn't really quite as simple as it looks. There's quite a bit going on behind the curtain there, and you know, as part of that effort to try to get a good idea of what's going on, you know, we started to go through a broker dealer, an SEC registered broker dealer, Zolfielli, who did a fairly significant run of due diligence through you and Paramount and all that. Tell us about what that experience was like. What exactly did he do? What kinds of things did did you kind of learn some things even through that process, I guess?
Well, it was a very robust, very thorough process. Zolfie, for those that know him, is a man of great diligence and really appreciated how he handled the process. And, you know, we're here to provide transparency. So the process was probably a 2 or 3 month process, maybe even a bit longer. I don't recall the time frame. Yeah. It happened around a year ago this time. And you know, it was very positive. We were able to kind of walk through all the parameters of what the concerns were. We were able to tie out revenue and allow him to connect dots to ensure the integrity of revenue streams. There was a lot of diligence done on revenue types. There was a lot of diligence done on fund revenue, you know, proceeds, revenue generation to support payments, those type of things. So a very positive process, and I compliment Zolfi for it. And, you know, we came through it with flying colors. And, you know, I think it lasted probably about 90 days, but it was thorough. It was robust. It was high level diligence that got into a lot of detail.
Yeah. I just want to point that out too, because I think, you know, you guys in Paramount was very open about everything and ultimately able to get even the financials tied out by a third party CPA, which was really helpful. Daryl, this has been fantastic. I think it's really dives into this stuff to a point where I think people kind of understand it more. I mean, otherwise, it's just sort of this cryptic, okay, ATMs, we're doing ATMs. But this is it's a sophisticated business, one that you've really grown quite a bit. And, you know, we're happy to participate alongside you in this WF Velocity ATM fund. Thank you so much for being on, man, and hope to connect with you again.
Yeah, we're thrilled for the partnership opportunity, and thank you for your time today as well.
We'll be right back.
Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. And just as a reminder, with regard to this fund, the ATM machines are considered personal property. And what that means is that you can use, and you do use, bonus depreciation on them. This year, what that means is the amount invested, you'll end up ultimately with a K-1 that shows 60% paper losses, because that's what bonus depreciation allows you to do. Now, I will say that right now it is 60%, but there is a reasonably good chance that that's going to turn into 100%, because it looks like the Congress is headed in that direction, and the House actually passed a bill extending that, and the Senate needs to go through the Senate. And if that happens, it's cool, because, you know, 100% bonus depreciation for those who can actually use that depreciation with other passive income, or, you know, just using it on the passive income that comes off these machines itself is a great, great tool. That's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.